Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hey everyone, this is Anna, and along with Nick and Chris, we would like to welcome you to Audio Journal Sports Page. This is a program by, for, and about sports, activities, adventure, and information involving people with a variety of disabilities. Okay, I'm going to start off my time here on Sports Page with this article I happened to find in our community advocate, and it is titled, She Inspires All. With a positive spirit, this Shrewsbury 8th grader is successfully managing type 1 diabetes. Between calculating carbohydrates, checking the glucose levels, and deciding where to place medical equipment on their bodies, it's estimated that people with type 1 diabetes make approximately 180 additional health-related decisions per day. All the extra choices can become overwhelming, but Catherine Kelleher doesn't fret. Despite dealing with a life-changing diagnosis in September, the Oak Middle School 8th grader has hardly missed a beat, continuing to thrive academically and athletically while managing all that comes with the condition. It comes down to faith, Kelleher told the community advocate. I saw it as something positive in a way. It was a challenge. I read my Bible every night, so I was thinking that God wouldn't give me a challenge he knew I couldn't handle. Catherine was a happy middle school student when medical issues began to arise. She wasn't growing or gaining weight, and though her family, including her mom, Kate, and father, Will, traveled to medical experts throughout the region, answers were difficult to find. Catherine started to feel really thirsty. Soon enough, Catherine couldn't make it to soccer practice. On September 8th, just days into the start of 8th grade, she was admitted to the hospital. After a quick prick of her finger, a diagnosis was delivered. You have type 1 diabetes. After 2 years of searching, the news came suddenly. The family was shocked. I was sad. I was like, what the heck? I wasn't expecting it, said Catherine. Added Will, it was a very black and white moment. It was shockingly diagnosed with pretty much a finger prick and a test of the blood. It was surprising with everything we had been through already. Catherine spent 3 days in the hospital learning about type 1 diabetes, an autoimmune condition that causes the body immune system to mistakenly attack certain cells in the pancreas, and how to use her technology and equipment, including a continuous glucose monitor. Type 1 diabetes requires a lot of carbohydrate math equations. It was a whole new language, Catherine said. But it was a quick language, she added, to pick up. With determination, Catherine learned how to make those daily decisions. Once upset at the diagnosis, her attitude started to change. It's as big of a hurdle as you make it. It's only hard if I make it hard, she said. She added, I'd rather do something good for myself, stay positive, and stay healthy. Support came just as quickly as her diagnosis. Catherine's best friend came to her house that night for encouragement, and several other friends delivered gift baskets. Soccer coaches, teachers, and school nurses all supported Catherine closely. The day after returning from the hospital, Catherine went on a 4-mile run. She's not the type to slow down, and with the support, she continued thriving in her everyday academic and extracurricular activities, impressing coaches and teachers. It's ironic that one of the Howells habits of work and learning we assess at Oak Middle School is perseverance. Catherine defines it, said Jason Ponticelli, one of Catherine's eighth grade teachers. She is a role model in her classroom and on the field, showing resilience, bravery, and grace. She faces adversity head on and inspires us all every day. She is amazing. In soccer, Catherine has been better than ever, competing for FC Stars ECNL and Oak Middle School team. She's able to participate in lacrosse, golf with her family, go fishing, and spend time with friends, all while managing her glucose. She'll continue her athletic and academic career at Worcester Academy next year. We didn't know what taking care of a child with diabetes entailed, said Kate Kelleher. We were sad for her, but we knew that she could do what she can do. We know what she's capable of. She led the charge. She got up the morning after coming home from the hospital and said, "Let's go." 8 months post-diagnosis, Catherine is feeling great, and now she's trying to inspire others. I'd like other kids, younger kids, but even older kids, to know that they can keep going. That they can keep going too, no matter what the challenge is, she said. So what a girl, I'll tell you. This is the attitude to take when you get a diagnosis or you get some news that's not your way. You can turn it around and make it the best. Okay, the next article I have in front of me is titled, "This Blind Runner Ran a Half Marathon with His Glasses Giving Him Directions." Thomas Panic was able to see the course and properly soak in the race atmosphere. At the start of a big race, most runners are juggling the usual things, squeezing into corrals, long porta-potty lines, and the creeping fear that their watch will fail them at the starting line. For Thomas Panic, the morning of the New York City half on March 15th came with all of that, plus a different kind of question mark. Panic is the CEO of Lighthouse Guild, a nonprofit that provides vision care and support to people who are visually impaired. Panic himself is blind, and he also is a veteran endurance runner. This year, he ran 13.1 miles across New York City with something new in his toolkit, AI glasses from Meta. Custom running technology co-developed with Lighthouse Guild AI, also known as LGAI, as a new initiative focused on building adaptive tech with blind and low vision leadership at the center. Start lines are always pretty stressful, Panic told Runner's World. But the nerves this time weren't about staying with a goal pace or inclement weather. It was more about technology from the standpoint of, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? It was much more black and white. What made the experiment unusual was the speed at which it was built. Panic said the team worked with Meta engineers to develop a proactive AI feature in the days leading up to the race, essentially customizing what the glasses would look for and communicate to him on course. The glasses essentially are looking around all the time, and you are telling it what you want to find, he said, describing a prompt building process that came down to the wire. It wasn't done until the night before at 7 p.m. Before race day, Panic and the team put the system through its paces in Central Park, testing on the lower loop, an environment that, as many New York runners know, is never just calm little oval. On the day of, Panic still ran with a guide runner, Jed Laskowitz, an Achilles guide volunteer he's run with before. The goal wasn't to remove the human element as much as to shift what the human had to do. Panic told Laskowitz the glasses would handle many of the traditional verbal cues, turns, water stops, basic navigation, so Jed could focus more on safety and flow. That handoff, Panic said, felt like a leap of faith. It's almost like taking your hands off the steering wheel when you're in a car, he said. There are things that it's going to do for me that have never been done before, and it's a strange experience. Panic was also very clear about what a guide can do that tech can't, at least not yet. He described a moment when a runner stopped suddenly after dropping a phone. Panic said Laskowitz clipped heels but avoided a fall thanks to Jed's quick reaction. Your guide is focused on your safety, Panic said. Even if a system can detect an obstacle, there's a lag between what a camera captures and what a runner can process and react at a speed, especially without vision. That gap, he explained, is the extraordinary challenge. When the glasses did shine was in delivering information that sighted runners take for granted. Panic pointed to something deceptively simple, accurate mile markers. GPS can drift and your watch may buzz 10 miles before you actually hit the 10-mile sign. But the glasses could see the marker and sync his stats to it. I've never been able to do that before, he said. They also helped with orientation during the race. Panic thought the course went over the Manhattan Bridge. Instead, the glasses told him it was the Brooklyn Bridge, a change from previous versions of the route that even caught his guide off guard. People are fallible, Panic said. The glasses, by contrast, stayed locked on the job and didn't get distracted. Near mile 11, Panic passed supporters from Lighthouse Guild, turning his head and using the glasses to describe what was happening on the sidelines. Shirts, logos, the cluster of his people. I've run 20 marathons, and I've never known, not once, unless somebody's yelling my name, he said. With the glasses, the world around him became readable in an emotional way for him that it hadn't been before. Racing is the high bar here with these types of advancements, but Panic emphasizes that daily life is the point. At Lighthouse Guild, he noted, the organization already trains people to use wearable tech for practical tasks like distinguishing a green pepper from a red pepper at the grocery store, or figuring out whether you've grabbed a can of apples or a jar of spaghetti sauce. And as Panic put it, sometimes what matters isn't a description of the elevator walls. It's where are the buttons? Overall success, Panic said, would be seeing the tech in the wild. People who are blind using glasses and moving more freely with an understanding of their surroundings. Whether that's through reading signs, finding bus lines, or navigating daily life with less reliance on others. He sees the moment as bigger than just a race like the New York City half. Since the beginning of time, people who are blind have had three ways of mobility, he said. A cane, dog, or a human guide. The ability to do things independently using technology is incredible. Blind runners do hard things all the time. The change here is being able to do them with tools that were designed with blind people at the center, and then carry that process to everything else that happens off the course. Because if there's success in an overly crowded half marathon, the day-to-day applications, transit, grocery shopping, using a hotel gym, start to look a lot closer than ever before. Technology is just remarkable. All right, my next story that I found is titled, These Paralympians Are Redefining How Para-Athletes Are Portrayed, and here's how. the Zatamoan when we had the Paralympics. Would you ever call a WNBA player an NBA player? For Czech, Aoki, that's the comparison he uses when he is called an Olympian. It's not a flattering title for Paralympians who already face coverage deficit. What media coverage Paralympians receive often involves around disability rather than achievement. Danny Aravik saw the gap firsthand in the lead-up to the 2024 Paris Paralympic Games when she worked for the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee. Aravik, 29, began posting more herself to change the narrative. It's the only way she could make an immediate impact. That innovative led to the founding of Cultured, a media collective dedicated to telling authentic stories from the Paralympic world. Aravik, alongside Aoki, Brenna Huckabee, and Ryan Neuswender, started moving the needle on a platform that could bridge the gap in coverage. I realized a long time ago that this didn't exist, Aravik said. While Milan Cortina will be the first games for which Culture is assembled, the initiative to progressively move the Paralympic needle into its own space, separate from the Olympians, but one where coverage mimics the level of elite sport. This is just the beginning, said Anna Johannes, the collective's newest member. It's a tip of the iceberg. Holistic view of the games. Increasing visibility for para-athletes is central to Culture's mission. If you don't see yourself represented, how do you know you can do it? Huckabee said. We want more disabled people in sports feeling like they belong in a place. The collective also works to redefine how para-athletes are portrayed. Coverage tends to lead with disability. Headlines celebrate how athletes overcame despite their impairments rather than focusing on how they compete at an elite level while living with those disabilities. Cultures wants the average fan to recognize how harmful the despite story is. Our goal is to call people out and to make it better and say, this is how you tell the sports stories without putting this sometimes unnecessary sob story disability lends to it, Aravik said. When Aravik calls out, she also wants to bring people back in. It's corrective, not rejective, something the collective wants people to realize to join the movement. Johanna says coverage tends to come from an unintentional ableist view, and the collective's goal is to inform. It's about calling people in and being like, this is exactly where you want to be. You are fans of this, and we're going to help you understand how to be it, right? Johanna said. And I think that's where we need in this gap. But part of the issue stems from access. For many fans, the Paralympics are their first exposure to athletes with disabilities. A humanities and social science communication study found that Japan, Malaysia, and the UK were on top three countries with the highest number of articles and photographs at the 2020 Tokyo Paralympic Games. A hole remains in the United States coverage, leaving access limited while coverage fades between Paralympic cycles. I want sports fans who claim they are sports fan and appreciate good sports to realize they're also a para sports fan, Aravik said. And for a lot of people, they just don't have that point of entry because it's not very accessible for people to get to experience it. Cultured is not seeking to replace traditional media, but rather provide a platform to bridge cycles to coverage. The collective plans to publish content centered around athletes aside from their disabilities, using the help of freelance writers, retired athletes, and content creators. Aravik also wants it to place for fans to learn about para sports, classifications, equipment, accessibility, challenges, and strategy. What I would love to see is that someone has a question about elite parasport they know to come to us, Aravik said. And if we don't know the answer, we'll know someone who can answer it. Until parasports are fully integrated, platforms like Cultured are necessary to ensure athletes receive coverage as elite competitors. And if that story becomes standard practice across the sports media, well, then we are doing our job, right? Aravik said. So there you go. All right, looks like I used all my time here on Audio Journal Sports page, so I'm going to hand it over to my guys. Thank you so much for listening, and here's Nick and Chris.
Thank you, Anna. Hi, everyone. This is Nick, and I'll be reading you a few stories here for this week's edition of AJ Sports. The first article I'd like to read is from uwosh.edu, U-W-O-S-H, and it's entitled Finding Purpose in Every Stride, UWO Football Player Pursuing Special Ed Blind Teen Become Sprinting Partners, by Gray Slim. Blind Oshkosh West sprinter Kiami Steven left, a description of the picture, powers down the track with UW Oshkosh football player Austin Eklund guiding him during a 100-meter race in April. Inside the echoing walls of a racket court in UW Oshkosh's Albee Hall, a rubber ball filled with three metal bells slams repeatedly against the far wall. The sharp rattle reverberates across the floor as Kimani Steven, a 17-year-old Oshkosh West High School senior who is blind, tilts his head and listens, pinpointing the exact moment the ball comes within reach before launching it again with precision. Standing against the left wall in the court, Austin Eklund, a UW Oshkosh junior majoring in special education and defensive back on the Titan football team, watches with quiet awe. "I mean, he's just incredible," said Eklund, who has known Steven since spring 2024 when he became the younger athlete's running guide. Steven runs 100-meter and 200-meter races for Oshkosh West High. Watching Steven train for the National High School Goal Ball Championships December 4th to 6th in Austin, Texas, is different for Eklund. As Steven's track guide runner, he's used to being tethered to him, watching stride for stride, guiding him around curves, helping him navigate high-speed races. But here, on the racquetball court, Eklund isn't guiding. He's witnessing a different kind of athletic skill at work. Goal ball, which originated in 1946 as a way to keep blinded WW2 veterans physically active, is considered the premier team sport for blind athletes, according to Texas School for the Blind and Visually Impaired, host site for the national competition. In goal ball, the ball contains bells that sound when in motion and thrown at a goal at the opposing team's end of the court. Steven wasn't born blind. A childhood accident triggered the loss of his vision, which deteriorated between ages 7 and 9 until he was considered blind by 6th grade. Multiple surgeries followed, along with glaucoma in both eyes. Today, he describes his vision as a shifting field of gray static, like what you'd see on an analog TV when it's not receiving a broadcast signal. How their paths crossed. Oshkosh West's coaching staff knew Steven needed a guide runner they could count on, someone who would show up every day, train consistently, and stay with him for more than a few weeks. He had already worked with two or three well-meaning student runners, but none had been able to commit long-term. That's when Joey Ray, Eklund's former defensive coordinator from Sussex High School, now head football coach at West, stepped in. Ray recognized that the team needed reliability, and he knew Eklund. He told me he had something different for me, an opportunity out of the ordinary, Eklund said. They had a blind student athlete who needed a guide runner. Eklund said yes, even though he wasn't a runner. In high school, he completed mainly in long jump and only occasionally raced the 100-meter dash. Becoming a guide runner meant transforming himself into an athlete who could run at 75% or more every day, just to stay even with Stephen. And it meant showing up every single day for 2 track seasons. My days during spring were wake up, football, practice, class, then West High School to run with Kiami, Eklund said. Every practice he was at, I was at. Every meet he was in, I was in. Running as one. Their first practice together was messy. The tether was bulky, the rhythm off, the communication still forming, but they kept going. At meets, Eklund noticed the way people sized Stephen up. The quiet, judgmental assumption that a blind sprinter was there for a feel-good moment, not to compete. Everybody just assumes he's going to show up and get a participation trophy, Eklund said. It's the furthest thing from the truth. Their first race silenced the doubters. In a JV 100-meter heat, they exploded off the line and left the entire field behind and dusted everyone, as Eklund put it. I was yelling, "You're freaking amazing," because I couldn't believe it. He said, and he just smiled. He's Mr. Cool. That's what he does. Before Eklund began guiding him, Stephen estimates he ran the 100-meter dash in about 13.9 seconds. With Eklund at his side, he dropped that time to around 12.5 seconds by the end of last season. They laugh now about early missteps, like the time Stephen accelerated so quickly in a 200-meter race that the pair got out of sync and both face-planted across the track. As soon as I fell, he fell, Stephen said. We just went flipping. Somehow it was only a couple scrapes. What they teach each other. Stephen says that trust is the foundation of everything they do. We're running full speed, so essentially I'm putting my life in his hands, he said. I don't think there's another way to measure the amount of trust in a person. Hearing that level of trust from Stephen was deeply moving for Eklund. What hasn't he taught me? Eklund said, choking up a bit. He's taught me how to be a better person, a better future teacher. He breathes life into the people around him. Stephen's goal ball training only deepened that admiration. I wish more people would really stop and look at how talented these people are, Eklund said. Kiami gets doubted before every race. If people paid attention, they'd see incredible athletes who compete at the highest level. Stephen now competes on a youth team supported by the Michigan Blind Athletics Association, the organization that first discovered him at a sports camp in Kalamazoo. He played alongside the Michigan Omega team in Chicago to gain experience. There are no goal ball programs in the Fox Valley, so he typically trains alone. That's why having practice time in Albee Hall at UWO has meant so much. In Albee, he focuses mostly on offense, experimenting with different throwing techniques from camps and tournaments. Director of Leadership Oshkosh Trina Wolt, who taught him in youth leadership or Oshkosh, has even stepped onto the court to throw balls at him so he can work on blocking. It's definitely a boost of encouragement, Steven says. A lot of athletes drop gold ball because they can't find places to cry. Now I'm excited to have this space, and I'm going to use it to the fullest. What stands out isn't his blindness, it's his character, said Wolt, who helped facilitate the use of the racquetball court for Steven. He chooses resilience every day. He pushes himself in ways most people never will. Wolt sees everything special on the partnership between Eklund and Steven. They model what inclusion looks like at its best, she said. Two people learning from each other. Matching pace, pushing past boundaries. Considering a future in special education. Steven, who grew up in Chicago, has been accused to UW Oshkosh and is strongly considering majoring in a special education. His mom works as a physical assistant in nursing homes, and his dad is a construction worker. Both have supported his academic and athletic ambitions as his vision changed. He said the idea of special education first surfaced in middle school, inspired by the adults who supported him. His paraprofessional, vision teacher, and orientation are mostly mother mobility instructor. They did a lot to influence my life, especially with sports, Steven said. They supported my aspirations both academically and outside of school. I really feel like I want to give back and invest my time into students the way they invested in me. UW Oshkosh is at the top of his list, even if he hasn't officially committed yet. I've met a few people here, and it's definitely growing on me, Steven said. I just want to make sure that wherever I go, I can give my all and keep doing the things I have. Their partnership has shaped both athletes, but Eklund says Steven changed him in lasting ways. He solidified that I'm on the right path with my special education monster, Eklund said. Working with him makes me realize this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Okay. The next article I would like to read is from Bournemouth.ac.uk. Visually impaired children experience sport for the first time at BU Sports Day. 22 children aged between 7 and 15 years old from across Dorset experienced a day of sporting activities, some of which they had only played for the first time, including goalball and racket sports. The event, which is in its second year, was organized in collaboration with Dr. Ben Powis, senior lecturer in sports at BU, and an expert in disability sport research and vision support services, part of Dorset Council, who work with children and young people with moderate to profound vision impairments. Dr. Powis explained, frustratingly, visually impaired children do not get the same opportunities to take part in sport in their mainstream power schools as their sighted peers. This event allows them to try out specially adapted sports early on in their lives so they can get the chance to enjoy being active and then progress to joining clubs in their groups. The feelings of being excluded from sport in mainstream schools can have a lasting effect on some children with visual impairments, as Charlotte Wingfield, a mother of one of the children participating in the sports day, said. Sports day at school is usually really traumatizing for my daughter, as she is always coming last and being left behind really upsets her. So coming here and seeing her feeling happy and relaxed and warm and all those things with other children with similar disabilities is amazing, not just for her, but for me as a parent too. B BU sport management and sport coaching students were on hand to explain the rules of the games to children who were using sports equipment for the first time, including a sound ball that contains bells which make a noise when the ball is in motion. This allows the players to hear and track the ball's movement. BU student Tabby Sinclair, studying for BSc in sports coaching, said, "As a student, today's experience has given me the opportunity to coach children with different abilities. I have never coached children with a visual impairment before, and to practice communicating differently and learning a new way of coaching is really insightful." Opportunities for BU students to work with a diversity of abilities is also adding to their portfolio of skills, helping them gain an edge on the competitive careers market in sports teaching. As student Bao Masters explains, "I'll be starting a PGCE in September to become a PE teacher and to have opportunities like this where I can experience adapting session plans, which will be required in some of the special educational needs, SEN work I do, is really valuable." Some children were able to demonstrate their improved skills as a result of joining their own sports teams in their local community, as Kira Knight, a habilitation specialist for Dorset County's Vision Support Services, explained, "We can now see the rewards from last year's Day Sports Day, where children who tried out sports for the first time are now active members of clubs in their own community, and they can finally feel part of a team. It has also helped to build confidence with other vision-impaired children and young people when they're often the only child with a vision impairment in their school. Parents are also benefiting by meeting other parents with children of mixed abilities and can share knowledge and support with each other." And that'll be it for me tonight on this week's edition of AJ Sports. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and I'll hand it off to Chris to finish this week's episode. Take it away, Chris.
Hello, listeners. It's Chris's turn up at the plate. Coming up, a couple of good stories for us to go through. First up, snowboarder Mike Schultz prosthetics give him and his competitors an edge. Few action sports athletes know as well as Mike Schultz what it takes to win and how much depends on mental and emotional strength as much as, sometimes more than, physical strength. Schultz was a motocross and snowmobile racer at the height of his abilities in 2008 when he suffered a knee injury that resulted in an amputation of his left leg right above the knee. Relearning to walk and using a prosthetic was the baseline for Schultz. He wanted to return to competition better than ever. The rigors of competing in his chosen sports were mismatched with the standard prosthetic Schultz was using, and he quickly learned that to compete at this high level, he would need to build his own. He did what he termed Moto Knee and VersaFoot, and founded a company, BioAdapt, to manufacture them widely once he realized how badly adaptive sports needed higher performing gear. He also learned how to snowboard in 2009, after his accident, and has since competed in 2 Olympics, Pyeongchang in 2018 and Beijing in 2022, and racked up 18 World Cup wins. Schultz competes in the SBLL1 class, or athletes who have a significant impairment to one leg, such as an amputation above the knee, as Schultz does, or a significant combined impairment on 2 legs. Now, most of his competitors are also using BioAdapt equipment. Approximately 30 out of 42 athletes on the World Cup circuit right now in the men's and women's lower limb classes, LL1 and LL2, use Schultz's prosthetics, though not all of the 42 athletes are amputees. At Pyeongchang in 2018, 15 athletes from 6 countries used BioAdapt equipment, resulting in 11 medals, including Schultz's gold in snowboard, cross, and silver in bank slalom. The number of athletes had risen to 26 from 11 countries by Beijing 2022, where Schultz took silver in snowboard cross. There's no question that Schultz and his other BioAdapt athletes' success at these games has created an association in people's minds between the equipment and snowboarding, but that's far from its only, even primary, use. A lot of people see BioAdapt on TV with the Paralympics, and they think it has a snowboarding leg, but that's just one of the several uses for our gear, Schultz said. The most common use of BioAdapt equipment isn't actually snowboarding. It's gym and fitness activities like CrossFit and strength training. The next highest use group is snow sports, then motocross, wakeboarding, and surfing. Schultz also works with a military channel like Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, Brooke Army Medical Center, and VA clinics to fit gear for service members who have been injured in the line of duty. The MotoFoot and VersaFoot Schultz initially designed are now in their second generation. The equipment has become lighter and is better able to be tuned to athletes looking to hone in on their performance. And that's where Schultz, the competitor, can bump up against Schultz, the engineer, the business owner, the mentor. At every World Cup event, athletes who use BioAdapt gear turn to Schultz, sometime in the staging area right before the race begins, for advice and assistance in fine-tuning their gear. Schultz always obliges, even goes out of his way to make himself available, and then lines up right next to these athletes and allow him to edge them up to the next level. Every lower limb amputee on the U.S. parasnowboarding team uses BioAdapt gear. Fellow U.S. teammate Noah Elliott is Schultz's direct competitor in the SBL01 class. In the Snowboard Cross World Cup at Lang, Switzerland, on January 23rd, Schultz and Elliott both landed on the podium, with Schultz edging out his 27-year-old U.S. teammate for second place. The time trial's results stood as final, as the final was canceled for weather. At the Snowboard Cross race in Lenk on January 24th, Elliott took first place in the final, and Schultz took third. Schultz was the top qualifier by a full second and had a bad start in the final, but pushed through and landed on the podium. It meant two podiums in 2 days for Schultz, an affirmation of his drive to keep competing. I'm thinking about the bigger picture of it. Yes, I'm a competitor, and I want to beat everybody in lining up against. But my competitive career has a timeline on it, Schultz said. I want to be a bigger mark on the sport and help progress everybody's performance. That's a huge win. That's going to stand a lot longer than me getting gold, silver, bronze, whatever the case. It is tough knowing that I'm putting effort into making my competitors faster, Schultz said, with a chuckle. So that comes down to me as an athlete having to work harder and be more prepared than they are, and just perform the best I can when it matters. Schultz was contemplating retiring from competition following Beijing 2022, especially since he was fulfilling a career ahead of him as the driving force behind BioAdapt. But Monster Mike knows he's not finished. I work with so many of the athletes worldwide. That in itself keeps me engaged in working with adaptive sports, specifically snowboarding, Schultz said. The way Beijing ended, I wasn't satisfied on multiple levels. I'm going to continue with the competition side and continue to work with the athletes with BioAdapt. If Schultz meets his goal for qualifying for the Milano Cortina 2026 Paralympics, he will be 44 by the game's opening ceremony. He is already the oldest U.S. snowboarder in the World Cup circuit. I have to work harder for it, for sure. But it's just the fact that things don't work as quickly as I could or as they should. And we have some younger athletes that are very capable of the race course as far as technique, Schultz said. You throw in that young energy, it's hard to keep up for sure. On the flip side, all the years of competitive career stemming back from my motocross and snowmobile racing and snowboarding career, I've learned so much. I can use that wisdom I've accrued over the years and make up for that young energy some of these other athletes have. Now, sticking with the winter theme of sports, we're going to start with It's True, Skiing Can Be Accessible Sport, How Travelers with Disabilities Can Enjoy. Any skier will tell you there's nothing quite like the feeling of whizzing down the mountain. It's peace and adrenaline all at once. The ski industry is also always looking for ways to bring that feeling to more people. And over the years, various nonprofits and resorts have worked together to make the sport an option for athletes across the disability spectrum. For disabled athletes, getting on the slopes with adaptive equipment can be a great equalizer. No matter what your disability is, You can go out there and enjoy it, one member of the ski team at the National Ability Center told USA Today during a visit in December. We're all just people doing things differently. The National Ability Center is an adaptive outdoor recreation nonprofit based in Park City, Utah. It has a ranch for various activities, a few minutes from downtown, and a major base near the Mountain Village Lodges. Along with other nonprofits like Challenge Aspen in Colorado and Achieve Tahoe in California, there's a big apparatus across the industry to make the mountains more accessible to everyone. Why accessibility in snow sports matters. Outdoor recreation is one of those things that's really fun while you're doing it, but the impacts are far more reaching. The National Ability Center's CEO, Willie Ford, told USA Today, "It's okay to dream. Look what we can do." Last winter, Achieve Tahoe completed more than 2,500 private half-day lessons for over 700 participants, and this season is entirely booked. This highlights the growing demand for people of all abilities to join in mountain sports. In Snowmass Village, Colorado, another nonprofit is working toward the same goal. You can imagine how much people with disabilities are underestimated by others. Around the country and in the world, no matter where you are, skiing is considered extreme. Lindsay Kegley, CEO at Challenge Aspen, told USA Today, "If you can ski, that opens up every possibility between sitting on the couch and skiing." Kegley said for athletes with disabilities, realizing they can ski in a way is opening the door to their full potential. I spent a week forgetting that I have a terminal illness, and that is a gift that no one is able to give. But these folks did it. I haven't smiled, laughed, and enjoyed myself like that since well before my diagnosis, Mary Grace Porter, a Challenge Aspen Military Opportunities participant, said in an email. How skiing became accessible. Mountain spokespeople often emphasize that skiing in general is a sport that allows the whole family to enjoy the great outdoors together. Adaptive snow equipment means family members with disabilities can take part too. Experts and advocates say it's not just about the gear, though. It's about having the right facilities and resources available to support the experience from start to finish. At the National Ability Center in Park City, a ski-in, ski-out lodge makes it easier and safer for athletes to transfer to their adaptive equipment rather than having to get lifted in on the snow. Ford and Kegley said true accessibility requires a holistic approach. Imagine if you're a person who uses a wheelchair for mobility. You're using a sit ski most likely, Kegley said. But if you want to grab food on the mountain, you might not have access to your wheelchair, which is probably parked at the base. We work with the resort for something as simple as parking wheelchairs at every restaurant on the mountain, she said. Kegley and Ford said it takes constant effort and adaptation to keep skiing accessible physically and financially. We're not an organization coming in like a bull in a china shop, Ford said. We have to change the narrative that accessibility is a huge financial burden to resort operators. On the physical infrastructure side, advocates say it's important for resorts to consider creating accessible features like lifts and lodges as they renovate and expand. On the financial side for athletes, skiing remains a challenging sport regardless of ability. Many adaptive students may find it difficult to join a standard group lesson, which contributes to higher costs. To help offset expenses, every lesson at Achieve Tahoe comes with a lift ticket for the day. The organization also offers scholarships for eligible participants and discounts for veterans. At this point in time, we're still really dependent on resort partnerships and on nonprofits like ours, Kegley said. The financial barriers of skiing are not going away. The industry itself is an expensive industry, but advocates are doing all they can to make the sport more accessible to everyone. Up next, accessible design. UO graduate student creates innovative gear for adaptive athletes. University of Oregon sports product design graduate student Lulu West doesn't play wheelchair basketball, but she loves it. For its ferocious, lightning-paced sport, 10 athletes use the same court and a basket as NBA players. Contact, though, regulated is allowed. Chairs frequently toppled. The U.S. has emerged as a driving force for the sport, said West, who created a revolutionary wheelchair basketball uniform for her apparel studio course. The innovative singlet is one of many inventions West continues to develop while earning her master's degree. I love innovating, finding ideas that are way out there but eventually work, she said. Adaptive sports enable people with disabilities to improve their physical and mental health. My dream is to work with these athletes and to help them perform at their best. A winding road led West to what is now a clear path forward, including a life-transforming accident, diverse academic pursuits, and a chance meeting with Susan Sokolowski, founder of the UO's Sports Product Design Program. West knows firsthand how an injury can change everything in an instant. She knows that pursuing a new dream often requires letting go of the past. And she knows neuroscience and biomedical engineering, knowledge she's putting to work through her novel product ideas. West had an opportunity to showcase her creation, named the Biohack Unitard, at last November's International Textile and Apparel Association Conference in Long Beach, California. The uniform helps wheelchair athletes move effectively, improve posture, boost reaction time, reduce fatigue, and increase circulation. It's making a big impression, but she's still tweaking its ventilation based on feedback from the athletes. The lightbulb moment. West noticed players were competing with makeshift gear, literally guarding gloves and duct tape. Conversations often gravitated toward equipment, what they needed, how to improve what they had, and the products they wished were invented. But she'd spent her undergraduate years studying prosthetics and medical devices. West didn't know anything about apparel or shoes. Call it fate or luck, a friend of a friend told her about the U of O, a new graduate program started in 2016 that fits squarely with her goals and its founder, Susan Sokolowski. The University of Oregon Sports Product Design students earn a master's degree while applying science and creative problem solving to develop innovative products. Through that work, they are encouraged to push the boundaries of society and sport. The program is based at the UO's campus in Portland, the center of a vibrant athletic and outdoor products industry. Graduates have launched successful careers at many of Oregon's hundreds of sports product companies, working in design, research, development, and engineer. By chance, West's mom was attending a conference in Portland, so she tagged along and met Sokolowski in person. West was so thrilled she started her admissions application that night. Students like Lulu are not only dedicated to creating innovative sports products, but also strive to foster a more inclusive athletic community, Sokolowski said. Her journey at the University of Oregon highlights the transformative power of determination and creativity in the field of sports product design. West's medical science background gives her exceptional insight into how the body works, a perspective often reflected in her creations. For example, the Biohack Unitard uses compression that flows with natural muscle and nerve patterns. It also compensates for damaged subcutaneous neuroreceptors. Big words there. When someone or something bumps into the able-bodied person, West said, neuroreceptors under the skin sense pressure and respond accordingly. The right muscles tense up instantly and subconsciously to prevent injury or falls. West's singlet, which can be worn under a shirt, pants, or shorts, simulates those muscle reactions for athletes with disabilities. West hopes the Biohack Unitard also might provide therapeutic support. An emerging body of research suggests that the use of compression in muscles below damaged nerves could stimulate nerve response. Then there's a smart shoe for postmenopausal women that West invented for footwear course. The shoes transfer beneficial impact to the body while filtering out potentially harmful forces. The many health benefits of strength and conditioning workouts for women over 40 include increased bone density from impact on the body, West said. However, exercise also poses injury risks, often from sudden, unexpected movements like an accidental slip. Her shoe absorbs 70% of risky forces while transforming the beneficial forces through the foot, leg, and the body. With Sokolowski's help, She's exploring a patent for the shoe design. West also designed a uniform for wheelchair rugby defenders, the blockers who stop opponents from scoring. Her jersey features padded compression sleeves and built-in gloves with hexagonal grip patterns. Players with missing hands or limited mobility can use their mouths to adjust the padded cuff. Thermoregulating pants wick sweat, help keep players in their chairs, and resist abrasion. West also worked with a wheelchair rugby team to develop shin guards. In addition to designing products, she's also helped the faculty members with 3D body scanning and data analysis. West also spoke about adaptive sports and the new role of designers at the U of O's Global Sport University Network Summit. Last summer, she interned for Eddie Bauer in Seattle, working primarily under its outerwear team and footwear gear, gadgets, and accessories team. From now until June, West is working on her thesis, which focuses on Paralympic high jumpers with classification of T63, those with absence of one leg above the knee. West is designing a spiked shoe for the prosthetic leg, with the different modular designs based on whether the sound leg is used on the inside or the outside of the running approach. Her compression running shorts will provide a tight fit and solid grip around the athlete's prosthetic, as well as lower back and abdominal support. Beyond such niche products, West's thesis will explore her broader, bolder aspirations to reduce barriers to participation, competition, and performance through design. You've been listening to Audio Journal Sports Page, our effort to look at sports from a different point of view. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. This is Chris, along with Anna and Nick. If you have any information on any disabled sports and would like us to share it with our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Thank you for listening.
Flowers roll out the red carpet for desired visitors like hummingbirds and bumblebees, with bright colors and petals that act as landing pads. But flowers are sometimes victims of nectar thieves, species that bypass the flower's intended route to nectar without picking up any pollen. Tennessee warblers might not look like crafty robbers. They're tiny yellowish songbirds with a white stripe over their eyes. But they specialize in hacking into flowers. With their short, sharp bills, they tap a hole into the flower's base and enjoy an easy meal as nectar drips out. Tennessee warblers do most of their nectar drinking in tropical forests on their wintering grounds. During the breeding season in North America, insects are their most important food source. In fact, these warblers may help protect trees from spruce budworm. When there's a budworm outbreak, Tennessee warblers eat almost nothing else. So these nectar thieves give back to their ecosystems in their own way. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Tom and Annalie Luman celebrate Bird Note with today's show. They believe Bird Note stories are a magical doorway to nature and all of its wonders.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system. Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.